Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Two bomb attacks struck Coptic churches in Egypt as worshippers flocked to church for Palm Sunday services, killing nearly 40 people in Tanta and Alexandria. As Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo, Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the blast.
Coptic churchgoers and rescue workers picked through the debris inside the St. George Coptic Cathedral in Tanta, north of Cairo in the Nile Delta. Pews were broken and overturned, and blood-stained clothing and body parts were strewn on the ground. Eyewitnesses say an explosion took place near the church altar as worshippers recited prayers on Palm Sunday, which begins the Christian Holy Week. A second explosion occurred hours later outside the main Coptic cathedral in the Egyptian port city of Alexandria. Police indicated a suicide bomber struck outside the church.
The U.S. Navy is sending a strike group toward the Korean Peninsula to bolster the U.S. presence there and send a message to North Korea, which this week conducted a ballistic missile test in spite of U.N. Security Council resolutions banning such launches. The strike group includes its namesake aircraft carrier, the USS Carl Vinson, as well as three guided missile destroyers. Pyongyang has repeatedly defied international warnings about conducting missile launches and testing nuclear devices. U.S. President Donald Trump has also called on China, one of the few nations with strong ties to Pyongyang, to take stronger action and to curb those nuclear ambitions. This is VOA News. Syrian warplanes have resumed flights from an airbase targeted in Friday's U.S. cruise missile attack, according to a provincial governor who said the base was operating for what he described as a first phase. The comments from the provincial governor, Talal Barazi, come just hours after the Syrian government said the U.S. missile attack on the airbase had caused extensive damage. Barazi did not offer further details, and the U.S. Defense Department referred questions about conditions at the airbase to the Damascus government. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson travels to Moscow on Wednesday, just days after the United States launched missile strikes on Russia's ally Syria. U.S. missiles struck the Syrian airbase in response to the Syrian chemical weapons attack that killed civilians.
I think the president was very clear in his message to the American people that this strike was related solely to the most recent horrific use of chemical weapons against women, children, and as the president said, even small babies. And we're asking and calling on Bashar al-Assad to cease the use of these weapons. Other than that, there is no change to our military posture.
And in the meantime, Britain's foreign minister Boris Johnson announced that he has canceled his planned Monday visit, citing developments in Syria have changed the situation fundamentally. Johnson said he did consult with Tillerson before calling off his trip to Russia. Secretary of State Tillerson heads to Russia after he attends the G7 foreign ministers meeting in Italy. Pakistan says Russia-sponsored international talks in Afghanistan must involve the United States in bringing peace to the war-riven country because Washington is the biggest stakeholder there. Moscow plans to host this week a new expanded round of multi-nation consultations and has recently launched with the stated goal of developing a regional approach for promoting Afghan security and a government-led national reconciliation with the Taliban. But the U.S. administration has already refused to take part in the conference, questioning Russian intentions and motives. Police in Venezuela's capital fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disrupt thousands of anti-government protesters Saturday, after the president, Nicolas Maduro's government, barred an opposition candidate from holding office. The demonstration came a day after the government barred Enrique Capriles from running for office for 15 years. Capriles told press protesters, "We can expect more outrageous actions by the government. They could do anything. More human rights violations. We have to resist, and I am here to resist too." Venezuela's political crisis intensified last week when the Supreme Court issued rulings curbing the powers of the opposition-controlled legislature. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
You know, this attempt to try to come to a consensus regarding the appointment process and the need for this process and the appointment itself to be consistent with expectations under the December 31st agreement.
The Democratic Republic of Congo opposition coalition is unhappy with President Kabila's newly appointed prime minister.
Basically, the process is going on smoothly in some areas, then in some other areas, we are faced with some challenges. But the commission is able to put a lot of measures in place regarding the issue of deploying additional registration kits in areas where we experience a long queue.
The Sierra Leonean Electoral Commission compiles a voter list ahead of the 2018 polls.
There's been at least evidence to suggest that there were massive crimes committed against the civilian population, and it was done by a former sitting head of state involving military forces and even police forces, but principally military forces.
And investigators uncover mass graves in the Gambia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila named Bruno Tshibala, a former member of the largest opposition party, as prime minister on Friday. But the appointment seems not to have gone down well with the main opposition coalition known as the Rassemblement. Félix Tshisekedi, leader of the opposition, criticized President Kabila for violating the December 2016 agreement by refusing to name a candidate of the coalition's choosing. Freddy Imbuyamu Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or Our Congo in the local Lingala language, told me the appointment of Tshibala has deepened the country's political uncertainty.
Apparently, the appointment did not meet the consensus critical mass needed for broad political support. And I think as a result, it's being met with skepticism. I think both domestically and within the international community, particularly those that are the partners of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Why is there uncertainty? Why are the members of the international community uncertain about this? What is wrong with Mr. Tshibala?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with Mr. Tshibala per se. I think it's about this attempt to try to come to a consensus regarding the appointment process and the need for this process and the appointment itself to be consistent with expectations under the December 31st agreement. I think that's where we're having the bit of the problem. And unfortunately, you know, we are just wasting so much time. In the last several months, there have been three prime ministers in this country. And this is really sort of neutralizing, I think, the executive branch of government and making it impossible for the country to begin addressing the problems that we are facing.
Where does this lead the agreement? And are we to expect a possible election this year, knowing that some amount of time have elapsed, and this they blame on the Rassemblement?
Well, I think what I'm saying is that we've wasted too much time. We've already finished the first quarter for 2017, and I'm just hoping that it'll be possible to work out something within the political sort of establishment here, and to do it very quickly so that we can begin the process of really implementing this agreement, and particularly the process of putting the electoral process back on course.
As a top member of the Rassemblement, what do you expect from now going forward?
Really, I'm unfortunately not in a position to say exactly what's going to happen because, as you know, I am with the Rassemblement still. And with the part of the Rassemblement that is working with Felix Tshisekedi, and as we speak right now, Peter, I'm not unfortunately in a position to tell you exactly what's going on around our friend Tshibala. I don't know whether they've started the process of putting the government team together. I hear that he's trying to reach out to the rest of us here to try to work at something so that we have what I've called that consensus critical mass that is needed to have a political sort of initiative that can really begin addressing the issues we are facing right now. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I really don't know exactly what's going on at this point.
Well, that is what some people are saying, that there appear to be fissures or strong divisions within members of the Rassemblement, which they blame to be the cause of the time wasted so far. What do you say to such criticisms?
Well, I mean, certainly would have been much better for all of us if all of us in the Rassemblement were approaching these critical issues as a united front. That was the case until the passing, unfortunately, of the late President Tshisekedi. And there have been frictions and tensions and quite some infighting within the Rassemblement since the passing of President Tshisekedi. This, unfortunately, is weakening our position and certainly is not contributing to advancing our political agenda. But with that said, I think it would be oversimplifying things to say that if there's no progress, the responsibility is squarely on the Rassemblement.
Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or Congo in the local Lingala language. He spoke with me from Kinshasa. The Sierra Leonean National Electoral Commission says it is implementing measures to address citizens' concerns regarding the ongoing voter registration process. The report of technical and logistical challenges across the country blamed for long queues which frustrated citizens who want to register to vote in next year's elections. This as the electoral body compiles a voter list to be used in the 2018 polls. I reached Albert Masakoi, spokesman for the Electoral Commission, to find out the electoral body's plans to resolve the reported challenges.
Basically, the process is going on smoothly in some areas, then in some other areas, we are faced with some challenges. But the commission is able to put a lot of measures in place regarding the issue of deploying additional registration kits in areas where we experience long queues. Additional kits have been deployed in order to mitigate the aspect of people staying too long in these queues. And also the area of deploying engineers in the events where we experience a breakdown of some of these kits. The engineers would go in and fix up whatever issue, and at the end of the day, we get the sensor back up and running.
What has been the enthusiasm of Sierra Leoneans who are legally 18 years to register to be part of this process so they can vote next year?
For different age brackets, we've experienced a lot of enthusiasm, but for, we call them first-time voters, there has been this enthusiasm because these are the class of Sierra Leoneans who are very much active on social media, and they've been doing a lot of engagement around social media, the level of experience, how they want to let the process look like. So as a result of that, when you go to some of these areas, you find out that a lot of them are out and about, very energetic, enthusiastic in ensuring that they are able to cast their vote for the very first time. So in doing that, registration is the channel through which they can be able to cast their vote. So as a result, a good number of first-time voters have been out and about. And what the commission has done also is to engage some of them at institutional level, wherein we engage them, we explain to them the need for them to experience it for the first time.
How many people does the Electoral Commission want to register for next year's election? What is the target?
The commission is targeting 3.5 million eligible citizens That actually is taken from the census data, the statistical data of persons who are 18 and over. And that is the target group, 3.5 million persons. We hope that at the end of the registration process, the commission would have been able to register at least 3.5 million Sierra Leoneans.
Albert, with some of these logistical challenges that you were talking about, will the Electoral Commission be able to resolve all these technical challenges before the compilation of the voter registers process is completed?
Well, the process is ongoing because if you compare the challenges that we faced during the first week, it was so much. But now, as we are into the third week, some of these challenges are no longer coming up. That tells you about the level of preparedness and the level of enthusiasm that the commission has gone out in ensuring that we are able to put some of these measures in place. For now, we have less complaints of some of these challenges. And because the commission has been robust enough in deploying extra kits, in deploying engineers, IT focal persons into some of these communities to ensure that we are able to fix these challenges, the better for the commission. And so looking at the updates that are coming in, the commission is satisfied that we are making progress.
Albert Masakoye is the spokesman for the Sierra Leone National Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Preliminary investigations in the Gambia have uncovered mass graves in parts of the country. Investigators suspect the bodies buried in the graves were opponents of former longtime President Yahya Jammeh, who ruled the West African country with an iron fist. Some Gambians say the mass graves are strong indications of extrajudicial killings perpetrated by the Jammeh regime. Dr. Alan White, former chief of investigations for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone, just returned from a trip to the Gambia. He told me the International Criminal Court has to investigate the human rights violations during Jammeh's rule.
Well, I just returned from the Gambia, and while I was there, there was an entourage that traveled out to one of the sites where those involved in an alleged coup attempt back from the United States that were linked back over to the Gambia. There were some mass graves, and they had uncovered those bodies, and they're actively investigating that right now. And this is clearly something that, at least seemingly right now, consistent with the continuance of crimes against humanity that occurred in late 2006 up to the present, would certainly fall under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Now, you'd asked me that before, and I wasn't certain at that particular time, but now that the former president is gone, there's been at least evidence to suggest that there were massive crimes committed against the civilian population, and it was done by a former sitting head of state involving military forces and even police forces, but principally military forces. These are crimes that fall under the jurisdiction of the ICC.
So would you anticipate the ICC go in and investigate and find all the perpetrators and punish them as a result of this?
Well, I would hope that the Gambian government would call on the international community to come in and do that, because clearly there is evidence to suggest that a preliminary examination is warranted. And clearly this falls under the jurisdiction of the ICC. And I know the people of the Gambia would like this. Right now, the capacities are very limited. There are some constraints there. And it certainly is something that is of grave magnitude involving the former head of state. So I think the ICC is a proper jurisdiction to come in and do that. And it's something that the current government is struggling with capacity to be able to handle this. They have so many other issues. This is one that clearly should be handled, in my judgment, my experience doing this for over 15 years, clearly should be handled by the ICC.
Will the decision taken by President Adama Barrow to ensure that remains a state party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC be of any help if the ICC were to come in to investigate these allegations of crimes committed against humanity during President Jammeh's rule?
Well, absolutely. The Gambian government under former President Jammeh had indicated that they were going to withdraw. That's not an easy process. So, number one, it's not happened legitimately. And the fact that President Barrow supports remaining a member of the Assembly of States Party is a good thing, and it also signifies or sends a signal to the international community and the ICC that he is a supporter of international criminal justice. So I'm sure that he would support this. They have jurisdiction. They're a signatory to it. And quite frankly, even though they have some capacity, they have a lot of things on their plate right now. And I think this is one that would be, again, in my professional judgment, it would best be suited to be handled by the ICC.
Dr. Alan Wyatt is the former chief of investigations for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Kenya is gearing up for a general election in August, with concerns by some that the poll could lead to violence. In 2007, contested presidential elections led to mayhem that left more than 1,000 people dead. Already, the political temperatures are said to be high as contenders campaign for the vote. Senator Kenneth Okongo-Mongari, a member of the Kenyan Senate and a lawyer, is among the presidential contestants. For VOA reporter Ruben Kiyama asked the senator what inspired him to run for president.
It's a long story, you know. It's something I wanted to do over 30 years ago. As I go, I'm 47, you know. I've been walking this path through my life to prepare to where I am. And I've seen an opportunity whereby I think I cannot put my head in the sand while Kenyans yearn for good leadership. First of all, we want to work heavily on the issues of the basic needs. 53 years of independence, over 70% of Kenyans cannot get water, 60% a meal a day. Medical services, averagely over 60% cannot access medical services, even though this is a devolved function. Secondly, to fight this monster called corruption. I have a plan. I'm the only one, I think, with a plan, considering the fact that I've not worked in government to be corrupted other than being in parliament. And my tenure in the Senate has not really tainted my track record. So I'm clean. If you got the wardrobes of the both ruling Jubilee regime and the opposition, they have stinking, corrupt skeletons in those wardrobes. They are pretenders to the throne. So that's the reason why I thought that this is the right time to talk to Kenyans.
How would you respond to critics who say maybe you are project?
One, I don't respond to ignorant people. But if there's any Kenyan who can even remotely connect me to this corrupt ruling regime, I'm not competing with distractions. Others are distractions. I cannot answer the distractions. They need to check my steps from the time I declared my candidature on 27th of December. And I'm going to talk about the shortfalls of the Jubilee regime, every up to 70%. But 30% also I have to talk about the bankrupts of leadership, of those people I'm accrediting to the presidency.
How would you deal with the issue of unemployment among the youth?
National Liberal Party, which I had now as a party leader, has a 5-point agenda. On the issues of unemployment, when we take power, we are going to cut the retirement age to age of 50. Why? I'm saying if somebody has worked for 20 years, they start a downward trend. We want people to retire when they are very young. You'll find they wanted to do other opportunities. Now we have devolved functions. If somebody retired with a nice package of 2 million shillings, 3 million shillings, they can go do farming as another passion, fishing. There are people who want to open institutes, hotels, and build the country. So in so doing, we have created lots of employment.
You've also been critical on the role of the Senate, which you belong to. What powers, for example, would you want to see in a reformed Senate?
When I came to the Senate, I was aware of its legal parameters. Again, we also want the Senate to be rotational in counties, have selective sittings. When the member county assembly is in recess, the Senate will be addressing issues. They will be just rotational. Those are the powers to address every matters strictly touching on county affairs. Even allowances, those are issues which will be addressed to give this a purely upper house position. Like now, you remember, in January, I wanted to impeach President Uhuru. The Senate is given the final say in impeachment. But do you know the originating house? The originating house of that motion which I prepared is the National Assembly. When I took that motion to the National Assembly and gave the court brigade, they say they don't want to touch it because they will give Mongare mileage. They refused. The people who want Uhuru out refused to impeach Uhuru because I had appealed a case whereby Uhuru had violated 16 clauses of the Constitution. So those are issues where we want to see that the Senate can be given some final say, and especially this sort of pendulum acts from, like the Senate comes to enact matters touching on the county.
Senator Kenneth Okong'o Mongari is a Kenyan presidential aspirant. He spoke with Ruben Chiyama from Nairobi. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, held a hearing Friday on South Africa's refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir when he visited the country in 2015. The ICC wanted South African authorities to detain and hand over the Sudanese leader, who is wanted on charges of genocide. For VOA, Martha van der Wolf reports from the Belgian capital, Brussels.
The International Criminal Court held a hearing Friday on South Africa's refusal to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir when he visited the country in 2015. The ICC wanted South African authorities to detain and hand over the Sudanese leader, who is wanted on charges of genocide. Marta van der Wolf reports for VOA from Brussels. South Africa told the International Criminal Court it was under no duty to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir when he came to Johannesburg in 2015. The ICC filed a complaint against South Africa for non-compliance after authorities there refused to detain al-Bashir. The legal representative for South Africa, Dire Tladi, told the court that South Africa has immunity clauses in every intergovernmental agreement for conferences.
There is no duty under international law, in general and in particular under the Rome Statute, on South Africa to arrest a serving head of a non-state party such as Mr. al-Bashir.
124 countries, including South Africa, are state parties to the Rome Statute, the agreement that grants the ICC its authority and jurisdiction. The Sudanese president was on South African territory for 2 days during a summit of the African Union hosted by South Africa. He hastily left the country from a military airport after local courts and the ICC requested his arrest. ICC prosecutor Julian Nichols says South Africa's non-compliance is so severe that the issue should be referred to the United Nations Security Council.
The obligation to arrest and surrender a suspect wanted on ICC warrants is one of the highest obligations a state party has to the court. Without state parties fulfilling that obligation, it's impossible for the court to exercise its most important functions and powers, its ability to put on trial those for whose warrants have been issued for the most serious crimes of concern.
The ICC does not have its own police force and relies on states to arrest and surrender those who are warranted by the court. Although Sudan never signed up to the ICC, a UN resolution referred to Darfur issue to the court in 2005. Prosecutors of the ICC charged al-Bashir with crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide for his role in the long-running Darfur conflict, a western region of Sudan. ICC judges are expected to make a decision about South Africa and its alleged non-compliance within the next 3 months. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Brussels.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, Brazil has surged to the top of the FIFA World Rankings for the first time in 7 years, replacing great rivals Argentina. Brazil also became the first country to qualify for the 2018 World Cup in Russia, their latest step on the road to redemption after the embarrassment and heartache of their World Cup failure on home soil in 2014. Brazil were dumped off top spot after their elimination from the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. Their new surge is in contrast to Argentina, who are in danger of missing out on next year's World Cup. Third in the newly released rankings are world champions Germany, followed by Chile and Colombia. Switzerland enter the top 10 up to 9th, with former number 1 Spain clinging on in 10th. Egypt is Africa's top-ranked nation, but is 19th overall. Nigeria and Tunisia have swapped in the only move in the African top 10. In EPO's rankings, Egypt tops at number 1, Senegal at 2, Cameroon number 3, Burkina Faso at number 4, Nigeria at number 5, DR Congo at number 6, Tunisia at 7, Ghana at 8, Ivory Coast is number 9, and Morocco is number 10. Meanwhile, Saturday, there were home wins for Gabon's Monana, Tanzania's Yanga, and KCCA of Uganda in the first legs of their Confederation Cup playoff ties. Monana scored a goal in each half to beat Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosas 2-1. In Uganda, it was the late goal that saw KCCA beat Al Masry of Egypt 1-0, and that was the same scoreline for Tanzania's Yanga over Mamelodi Algiers of Algeria. In Saturday's other matches, Angola's Recreativo Libolo drew 1-1 with Snaps of Madagascar, while Bidwest Wit and Egypt's Smoha played out a goalless draw in South Africa. In Tanzania, Young Africans, better known as Yanga, also won 1-0 with Zimbabwe's Thabani Kamusoko scoring after 66 minutes against Mamelodi Algiers. The second legs of the playoffs that pit the losers from the Champions League against winners from the earlier rounds of the Confederation Cup are on the weekend of April 14th to 16th. On Sunday, TP Mazembe tried to repeat last season's feat of winning the Confederation Cup after demotion from the Champions League. The DR Congo side is hosting Algeria's JS Kabayale in the first leg of the Confederation Cup playoffs. Mazembe are involved in the second-tier competition after losing in the Champions League round of 32 as they did last year. Rail Kadiago of Burkina Faso meet CX Safaskien of Tunisia, winners of the Confederation Cup a record 3 times. Zesco United of Zambia are away to Enugu Rangers of Nigeria. The only tie between clubs from the same country involves FUS Rabat and MSAFS of Morocco, both former Confederation Cup title holders. And on to athletics. In 1 month's time, the IAAF Diamond League gets underway in Doha, with the first meeting of the 2017 series being held on May 5th. In its biggest restructure since the series began in 2010, this year's Diamond League will adopt a championship-style model whereby athletes each earn points at the first 12 meetings to qualify for the 2 finals. In previous seasons, athletes accumulated points through the IAAF Diamond League season, with the overall winner of each of the 32 events being the athlete with the most points, irrespective of whether they won the final. This year, the winners of each discipline in the finals will be crowned as the Diamond League champions, earning a $50,000 bonus and the Diamond Trophy. And Jemina Samgong, the first Kenyan woman to win an Olympic gold in the marathon when she triumphed in Rio last year, has failed an out-of-competition dope test. According to officials, the 32-year-old, who is also the reigning London Marathon champion, tested positive for the banned blood booster EPO in a test by the International Association of Athletics Federations in her native Kenya. On Friday, the IAAF confirmed it had started an anti-doping rule violation case concerning Jemina Samgong. Samgong, who also tested positive for a banned substance in 2012, starred at the London Marathon last year, defying the odds to win despite suffering a bruising fall. Steeled by her success in London, she then became the first Kenyan woman to win Olympic marathon gold, defeating Ethiopia's world champion Mary Dibaba in Rio to confirm her status as the world's top marathon runner of 2016. Before news of her positive drug tests emerged, Samgong had vowed to defend her London title on April 23rd. But Samgong will now not run in London on April 23rd to defend the title she won last year, according to the London Marathon chief executive Nick Beattle. Samgong's former training partner, the 2014 Chicago and Boston Marathon champion Rita Jepto, is serving a 4-year ban after also testing positive for EPO. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Chiboda wala no we moto kanga na yeja kore da dunda jotsasi. Chief Friday, baji teka boka unye mutu leka tujibandule. Baji tete ya gariza, haita mungu itufirina mubale keka babugume. Bani buzi zo chikorotia, noli ya chikorata, na tuigila kofena de tufuna. Habani buzi zo vifurotia, mubafuna mucha, Uganda, we need a remedy. Naya, kwati Uganda, ita mufe kwetu fevi.
She got me dancing, party, fiesta, forever. Yeah, you can be some and I need my Lisa. Dancing, party, fiesta, forever. They see me so, I will never let you go.
Paka na pata mikadi, wakuna taka mikadi. Kote mini po, sema beautiful, I'm in love.
I'm gonna give you what you need, let me give you what you need. I'm in love. Hey, I'm gonna give you what you need, let me give you what you need. She got me dancing, party, fiesta.
Cabeça, mena, animaliza.
Dance, party, fiesta.
I keep talking.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Hopefully, many African policymakers, scholars, and pundits are following closely what is developing in South Africa as it may relate to the demand that President Jacob Zuma should resign the presidency. Over the last 2 or 3 years, we have had accusations against President Zuma for corruption regarding his houses in Durban, his attachment to the Gupta family, and the fact that the Gupta families were detecting who should be ministers in his cabinet. But this crescendo of demand for his resignation increased after his massive reshuffle of 9 ministers, including the finance minister, beloved by the financial community. The question then is, what should the president do, or what should any African president do when found in such a situation? Simple civics tells us that in the cabinet you have collective responsibility, and if a minister does not share the views of the cabinet of the president or prime minister, he or she may decide to resign. But if they decide to stay, it becomes incumbent on the president or the prime minister to remove that minister. But in South Africa, we are told this could not happen. The reason being that the finance minister have been following strictly the so-called Washington consensus of the World Bank and the IMF, and that he gives confidence to the investors and the financial community. Then what is the implication for governance? That you have somebody who may not want to follow the policy of the government. Recently, the president talked about radical economic changes. He talked about the sacrosanct land policy. And the minister, the finance minister, is not supporting these. But if he should retain the minister at the end of his term and nothing changes, it is in his legacy. Anyone who is familiar with the South African policy and the sentiment in the country will tell you that the overwhelming majority of the black population believe that since apartheid ended in 1994, the economic situation has not changed. The control of the economy still retains in the head of its tiny minority. So this is the dilemma that the president faces. And he will have to face soon a no-confident vote in the assembly. On Friday, there were large-scale demonstrations in many cities organized by the opposition party Democratic Alliance. There were also pro-Zuma demonstration. And we don't know what is going to happen because the currency is falling. The rating agencies have gone to junk bonds. The people have begun to feel the pinch. And this is not good for the country. So this is the dilemma which I think most Africans should ponder. And surprising too to me is that in all of this discussion, no one has tried to link this opposition to Zuma with the forthcoming election for the new president of the country. It is true that key members of the party, Ramaphosa, Kusatu, and the Communist Party, are all opposed to Zuma. But we know now that there are 2 leading candidates for the next presidency of South Africa. One is Mrs. Nkosi Dlamini-Zuma, who just left her position as the head
of the African Union, and Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa, a former union member, now a capitalist. And all the opposition to Zuma are those who are supporting Cyril Ramaphosa. And those who support Zuma are those supporting his ex-wife. So these things should be taken into account when we evaluate what is happening today in South Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter and producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when a bird decides to dance in the pathway to the farm, its drummers are in the nearby bush. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
By a unanimous vote on March 31st, the UN Security Council adopted a resolution extending the mandate of MONUSCO, the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for another year. The Security Council also lowered the cap on the number of UN troops deployed in the DRC from 19,815 to 16,215. In addition, the resolution allowed for the replacement of some troops with more highly trained, specialized units and included specific performance indicators for troop-contributing countries to be reported on by the Secretary General. The resource-rich DRC has suffered from rampant corruption and violent fighting between dozens of armed factions, resulting in the deaths of an estimated 5.4 million people since 1998. In addition, there have been 107 fatalities of peacekeepers in the DRC since 2010, including 9 in 2016 alone. In March, two members of the DRC group of experts, one from the United States and one from Sweden, along with their Congolese interpreter, were found dead in Kasai Central Province, serving as a reminder of the continued threats facing UN personnel in the DRC. U.S. Permanent Representative to the UN, Ambassador Nikki Haley, applauded the Security Council's renewal of the MONUSCO mandate and for its action to make the mission stronger and more effective. When we look at these peacekeeping missions, what we need to focus on is not the number of people we have on the ground, it's the quality of the work that's happening on the ground, she said. We can have thousands and thousands of troops, but if they're not really working to keep the Congolese safe, none of that matters. Ambassador Haley said she was pleased that the Security Council, along with the troop ceiling, made sure that where the troops are, they are actually going to be more effective. The key, she added, is to make sure that the elections are safe, to make sure we're keeping people safe. The most important priority must be the protection of civilians, Ambassador Haley emphasized. Of great assistance in that, she said, is holding troops accountable for their actions. She welcomed the Security Council's request for a strategic review by September 30th. What we can't do is walk away and say our job is done, Ambassador Haley said. What we need to do is keep looking and making sure that what we did is actually working and effective and meeting our goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.